WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Humanity has entered a nasty, brutish, Hobbesian world where rising seas will drown the world's coastal communities, parts of the Earth will become too hot for humans to live, and millions of climate change refugees will pour into the United States, Canada, and Europe, straining food, water, and energy supplies, as well as human compassion. And so begins Oren Pilkey's newest book, Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change. Pilkey, along with half a dozen co-authors, lay out the coming catastrophes, floods, drought, heat, both marine and terrestrial, more frequent and severe storms, air pollution, sea level rise, ocean acidification. It would be a bleak read indeed, if not for the resources, helpfully labeled What to Do. Today, we'll learn about what we can do for ourselves, as well as what scientists are working on for global adaptation. Dr. Oren Pilkey is Emeritus James B. Duke Professor of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University. He's written more than 45 books, and he joins us now from WUNC in Durham. Dr. Pilkey, welcome back to Coastline.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, in my introduction, I read the first paragraph from your introduction to Escaping Nature. So tell us, what is some of the timing on this? When will this Hobbesian world take hold?
Well, it turns out that predictions of the of things like sea level rise and temperature changes in the past are not very accurate so far. There are many things that we don't understand. But it's certain, for example, something like sea level rise, which we can't predict accurately, but it's no question, everybody agrees that it's going up and that it's accelerating. And so, which means we got to look out for that, to put it mildly.
Do you have any idea, climate change refugees will be fleeing from certain parts of the Earth for a host of reasons, partly because places will become too hot to live, partly because the water supply will dry up. There are all kinds of reasons. But when do you think the U.S., Canada, and Europe will start to see this influx of climate change refugees?
Yeah, it's important to know that we here in North Carolina are living in a state that we are told is going to become unlivable because of the heat. But no one, it'll probably be, if I had to give a timing, it would be at least a century. And it would depend on so many things that are hard to predict. But the thinking of the scientists that look at this is that most people who are going to migrate to 45 degrees latitude. We're here at 35 plus or minus latitude. So that would mean really going, we would have to migrate to, well, we'd be really well off if we go to Alaska. Basically, we're going to have to go north and up. The only city, only part of North Carolina that's considered will still be livable when this heat comes upon us is Asheville, North Carolina.
In the western part of the state, in the mountains.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, in the mountains. So we go north and up, and that's north and up. But Idaho, Montana, Michigan, Pennsylvania, parts of Pennsylvania,
these
New
will
Hampshire,
be climate change havens.
Those will be climate change havens that we have in this book.
Now, let's talk about sea level rise for a second, because you've said, so North Carolina in 100 years or so, maybe sooner, we don't know, is going to be too hot to live. Some might argue it's that way right now, but personal preference there. So in the Raleigh News and Observer, Adam Wagner just published a piece about the new study in Nature that shows land is sinking on the North Carolina coast, which means thousands more people will be facing threats from high tide flooding. And Wilmington is one of the cities that was in that study. So it's the story of land subsidence coinciding with sea level rise. How do these phenomena work together?
Well, the land thinking, which is a real observation, but it's very slow thinking. But it basically will, if it sinks 2 inches, then the sea level rise is up 2 inches. It's directly related. There's no question of that. And there's no question that that's a problem. I think, though, that the sea level rise is going to be quite a bit faster and quite a bit more important than the subsidence. But the subsidence is there, and it's a factor, no question about it. And it varies from place to place. Sometimes the subsidence is due to extraction of groundwater for drinking purposes. Sometimes it's due to compaction of the sediment due to the weight of buildings and things like that. New York City, Manhattan is sinking,
right,
of course, with very heavy buildings.
Right. So we're looking at a larger threat of sea level rise then. And you have said in the book, Escaping Nature, that you wouldn't invest in property on the coast, because eventually coastal communities will be underwater. Which generations do you think? And again, it's another timing question, which I realize scientists hate having to predict things, right? But if you were advising your own kids or your grandkids, what would you say about when you need to flee the coast? Is it now? Or is it in 10,
well,
20 years?
Well, when my parents, when they're deceased now, but when they retired, they were thinking about going to the Outer Banks and buying a beach cottage or something to actually live in. And I certainly oppose that. I think now that I've looked at the big picture here that the Outer Banks are a dangerous place for people to live. Part of it is, of course, the islands are low and narrow, and the wave energy is high. The highest average mean wave energy in the United States, in the eastern United States, is in the Outer Banks area, and that means the highest waves. But besides that, a big problem is Highway 12. Highway 12 is a two-lane highway with sandy shoulders. And we know from a lot of experience, and not so much on the Outer Banks, but in various other places, that when you have a massive fleeing of a large number of people because of a storm warning, that you have people running out of gas, you have people having fender benders, you people having flat tires. We're all human beings, of course, and these things happen, and it makes escape from places like the Outer Bank very difficult. And there's not much high land on the Outer Bank, you know, land to go up and walk up some of the high dunes. But basically, as North Carolina coast goes, the Outer Banks perhaps are the most hazardous. But any living on a barrier island anywhere is a risky proposition, becoming more so by the year with every increment of sea level rise. And of course, at the same time that the sea level is rising, the global climate change is intensifying storms. We are having already bigger storms, not necessarily more frequent, but bigger, and that's not helping the situation.
Right. And Dr. Pilkey, you have something you wanted to read, said recently,
yeah,
by the UN Secretary General.
Yes, I'd like to read this if you let me.
Yes.
Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing, global temperatures keep rising, and our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. We are on a highway to climate hell, with our foot still on the accelerator. And that's by the Secretary General.
When did he say that?
A couple years ago. So it's still valid. It's certainly I'm sure he would agree with that statement.
It's interesting, and you observe this in the book, Escaping Nature. It's hard for human beings to grasp this, as ubiquitous as climate change discussions are, and as much as the mainstream media now talks about elements of the weather and natural events that are a result of climate change. We hear it, we may get it intellectually, but do you think we're still in denial on some level?
I think, repeat that question.
Do you think that we're still in denial about...
Oh, yes. A gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina in the next election is a strong denier of climate change. He says it's not climate change, it's seasons. You know, it gets cold in the winter and hot in the summer. But, for someone at that level to have that outlook on it is a sign that there are still some people that need education on this. And I hope our book will be part of that.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of how climate change is impacting the world, and especially southeastern North Carolina, with Duke University's Orrin Pilkey. We're going to learn about some adaptation strategies in the next segment. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Dr. Orrin Pilkey is Emeritus James B. Duke Professor of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University. He's written more than 45 books, and in 2024, Duke University Press published Escaping Nature: How to Survive Global Climate Change. Now, Orrin Pilkey, since we were just talking about sea level rise and how it's going to be impacting North Carolina, just want to talk about, before we move on to other disasters, what are some of the ways that local residents can prepare for sea level rise and adapt?
Yeah, one thing you want to prepare for sea level rise is be prepared to flee, to be a temporary, at least. To get out of there. And that's what I saw in our research for this book, is that everybody seems absolutely surprised by the fact that they got that water that high. How could it get that high? And then they're not prepared. You know, you don't have gas in your car. You don't have... all kinds of stuff that you might want to have when you, I would say during our storm season, if I lived on the coast, I would have a car packed with emergency things so I can escape readily.
Right, and a full tank of gas is part of that. That's an important part of it. You also talk a lot in the book about a bug-out bag. What's a bug-out bag?
A bug-out bag is a kind of a standard bag of stuff that you should have in a bag ready if you're concerned, and having a bag ready to go with you. It would involve food. Usually it's food, but also medication and maybe even reading material and just everything that you would like to have to be comfortable as you flee the storm.
One of the other things that you said in the book about adaptation, I thought there was something about building seawalls. And I thought, Orrin Pilkey, the Orrin Pilkey that I've spoken to in the past and read of, has railed against hardened structures to manage the ocean. But do we need to start building seawalls in some places?
Of course, I've spent a long time, as you've all recognized, opposing seawalls. Basically, I think one way to look at the ocean, if you're living there, you're going to experience the big one, the big one. And the big one is the storm of record. It seems like everywhere there is a big one, and it's even in the scientific literature. And these big ones go right over the seawalls. Most seawalls are vulnerable to a reasonably possible big storm. And of course, seawalls destroy beaches. And why are you at the coast if you don't have a beach? Most people are there because of the beach or like to take advantage of it. So seawalls, but maybe they're better than beach replenishment, which in North Carolina, a replenished beach was a minimum of $1 million a mile and up to $10 million a mile in North Carolina. the beaches last 3 or 4 years. Right. In 3 or 4 years, you have to do it all over again. And why should we be paying for that? Why not take that money and move the buildings back or something like that? But for us to have to continue to pay again and again to save houses and houses that will, when the big one comes, they'll be trashed anyhow.
Right. Now, hurricane intensification, as you've said, is part of climate change. We're talking about stronger hurricanes, and we're also talking about more frequent hurricanes. What kind of intensification are we seeing along the Atlantic, especially off the coast of North Carolina?
I remember there was a nor'easter storm 2 years ago on the Outer Banks, and it was just a minor. It was an important storm, not a big one, and just that not big storm blocked Highway 12 and other highways in the state with sand overwash, and nobody could get off or get on the islands for about 2 days. And if that had been a big storm, a big hurricane, not being able to get off the island could be a fatal problem. And so it's important, very, very important to be able to get off islands. By the way, a 2 to 3 foot sea level rise, this is something determined by Dr. Hal Wanless of University of Miami, who's been working on this. A 2 to 3 foot sea level rise, according to him, and I think he's right, that will be the end of barrier island development around the world. Because the 2 to 3 feet is not gonna submerge the island, but there will be overwash blocking the highways, blocking the roads, and so forth. So, barrier island development is a wonderful thing. We've always enjoyed going to barrier islands and swimming and so forth. But in the big picture of things, I think barrier island development is not. A stable possibility for people with long-range plans.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with retired Duke University professor Orrin Pilkey, author of more than 45 books, his most recent, Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change. Now, Oren Pilkey, you have very strong views about how leaders should be handling evacuations ahead of severe storms. In fact, you point out in the book how little we've learned over the decades about how to handle traffic. And we've seen some disasters on major highways when officials have not opened up all lanes of traffic to people who need to get out. What is the right way to handle interstate traffic?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The first time I saw that with a hurricane that struck near Charleston, this is several years ago, it struck near Charleston, South Carolina. And they opened up all the roads, the interstates going out for escaping, but the interstates coming in were left open. And so you have these photographs of massive lines of cars jammed together, often stopping, and the interstate lanes going the other direction are empty. And it's been agreed now, I think, that we must open up all interstate roads going to go the same direction to get out. And that's more or less happened since a couple of events, such as the one in Charleston.
Now, let's talk about tornadoes for a minute, because these are serious threats to communities in southeastern North Carolina. You say in the book that properly built safe rooms can actually offer real protection. What would a coastal safe room look like? Because we don't generally have basements here.
Okay, I didn't understand that question.
How can coastal residents best protect themselves against the threat of tornadoes?
Ah, yes. One thing that's interesting about tornadoes is that it's not clear that climate change is changing the intensity or frequency of tornadoes. However, I'm just saying it's not clear. Maybe it is. But what is happening is Tornado Alley is moving east from where it used to be. And that's not good news for North Carolina. But building codes, North Carolina has good building codes, good requirements for building. And when I first learned about building codes, I started going around in wintertime when people went around and looking at houses and how they were constructed. And I could see that different communities had different degree of enforcement of the building codes, and it's really important. You want to have, if you're going to live there anywhere near the coast, you want to have strict adherence to building codes for your house, for sure. Much of it's common sense. You don't want sills sticking out that the wind will pick up, and so forth. But it's critical, and it makes a big difference. I first discovered this myself when I visited my parents' retirement home in Waveland, Mississippi. And my father was an engineer, and he was interested in construction, and he took me around the town to look at building construction. And he showed me buildings that were built well and buildings that were built poorly. And after the storm, we did the same thing. And oh my, the buildings that were built poorly were the ones that really suffered from the high winds.
Can you just give us an example of what makes a building built well? Like, what was the difference?
Yeah, okay. let's see. You need everything well connected. That's the best way to put it. Everything should be well connected most of it is common sense. You can stand around a building and assume that there's a 60 mile an hour wind right now, maybe 100 mile an hour wind. was that really built well? Was that really connected well with the roofs? If the roofs have extend out beyond the rooftop, that makes a ledge which the wind will pick up and carry away. I mean, that's a loss of a roof is a common thing in a hurricane. But it's common sense that thing sticking out there is going to be picked up. But if you do have it sticking out, it should be really anchored very, very well. And I think it's very much common sense. And and there's a lot of literature on it. That's literature that's easy to read by people who aren't carpenters.
Now let's talk about air pollution for a moment, because in the book you write about this as being a function, the increasing air pollution is a function of climate change as well. And you write it not only exacerbates heart and lung diseases, which we know, but it also makes us stupider. How does air pollution dumb us down or affect our cognitive abilities?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that this is something that everybody looks at, agreed upon, but a polluted air with a high carbon dioxide, for example, apparently affects our thinking. And I think it's more than just worrying about it. It actually can be seen to affect our thinking, our arithmetic capabilities, and so forth, things like that. And of course, what the biggest air pollution problem now in the United States, especially in the eastern United States, well, western also, is smoke from forest fires. And there was a lot of problems in, for example, in New York City with people who already had breathing problems or lung problems getting sicker because of the smoke in the atmosphere in downtown Manhattan.
Right. That's right. And you also, in the book, you talk about paying attention to the air quality index and staying inside on days when it's particularly bad outside. But you also have recommendations for air pollution inside the home, including you say we should not engage in gas cooking. Do gas stoves seriously harm our health? You also suggest doing away with candles and not boiling or broiling or frying food.
Yeah, you know, gas cooking in a storm situation should be avoided.
You're talking about during a storm.
Yeah, mostly during. I think gas cooking. Well, of course, gas cooking is always dangerous, and surely you must, you know, most people understand that. But there were cases that we ran into where people, you know, in all the hustle and bustle and the storm and all the worrying about it, and all, next thing they know, whatever they're cooking is burning and so forth. And so it's best to keep life as simple as possible, and do as little gas cooking and other kinds of power that might create a problem. If the house is damaged or something. It's common sense, pretty much.
Now, the New York Times recently reported on a trend among large utilities, energy sector, who have had financial incentives to build new gas plants so they can recover their costs to build these plants and other equipment from ratepayers and also make some profit. And as a result, critics say utilities often overlook or even block ways to make existing power systems more efficient or integrate more renewable energy into the grid. And in fact, we've been hearing that Duke Energy is going to had promised to slash planet warming carbon dioxide emissions by 70% by 2030. But earlier in 2024, Duke warned it's going to miss that target by at least 5 years with a new plan. So what do you think about this seeming trend from utilities away from decarbonization goals?
That's what the Secretary General was talking about in that comment, in that statement that I read, that we really need to buckle down. You know, it's a really difficult problem because we have other countries in the world besides the United States. And how good is China at doing this? And how good will Siberia do with production of greenhouse gases? It's a major problem. We're on a highway to climate hell, as the Secretary General said, because carbon dioxide in Hawaii is still going up on the mountaintop, and the climate is still warming, and the ocean is warming and raising.
Right. You're listening to Coastline. Dr. Oren Pilkey is the author of Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change, published in 2024 by Duke University Press. Still ahead, some climate adaptation strategies for cities and wildfires. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Climate change is coming for life on Earth in the form of floods, more severe and destructive storms, drought, ocean acidification. I could drone on with a bleak list of impacts for another 5 minutes. The point is, humans need to start changing the way they live on planet Earth. In his newest book, Escaping Nature, retired Duke University professor Dr. Oren Pilkey says there are ways to mitigate, adapt, and survive. And I do want to just point out, Dr. Pilkey, that in the book you talk about how Pakistan's prime minister, one of the countries suffering the most from climate change effects, like catastrophic flooding and drought, those places that suffer the most seem to be the ones that contribute the least to the problem. China and the U.S. are the biggest CO2 emitters, but Pakistan and Africa are places who emit little but suffer the most. What would you say world leaders need to do about this?
That's a fact, what you said, that those who, and often the leaders of these countries. Now, Pakistan at one point was one-third of the country was flooded from an Indus River, massive flood of the like they've never had before. And he did make that statement. And others, when they've suffered something extraordinary in terms of climate change, have recognized the same thing, that why are we getting, we didn't do this, we aren't the one that committed brought in the CO2. I mean, this should make us all the more anxious to change our ways, not only to protect ourselves, but to protect other countries as well. And it's going to be very difficult to coordinate all the countries in the world, but especially if we can do good with China and the U.S., we'd make a major step forward if we can reduce some of our CO2 production.
Now, in the last segment, you said that one of the biggest reasons for air pollution is wildfire. And you write in Escaping Nature that wildfires are rapidly becoming the face of climate change. And the UN said in 2022 that wildfires are, well, spreading like wildfire. You say they're getting larger, they're causing more damage to homes and degrading ecosystems. But is this one climate disaster that coastal North Carolinians generally don't have to worry about?
No, it will happen. For one of these big fires to occur, usually what happens, there's a period where there's very little rainfall, kind of the beginning of a drought. And that's when the fires, maybe, you know, everybody's getting fires from lightning strikes and cigarettes and whatever. But when you get that dry, all the fire all of a sudden really, really grows. And
what are some ideas then for adapting?
It depends. If you have a house, and you're in, you know, North Carolina has a lot of forests, and we have a lot of houses in those forests on all parts of North Carolina, and what we've seen in doing the research for this book is that in many cases, the piling up of wood chips along the side of the house, kind of as a decoration type thing, adds to the hazard. And you don't want to have a forest, a natural forest floor coming right up to your house with leaves and all that. You want to get rid of the leaves. You want to use lawn, or you want to use gravel, or you want just use common sense and walk outside your house. Is a fire starting in the nearby forest comes my way, is it gonna get to my house?
So all this, I mean, there's a local sort of design leaning here in southeastern North Carolina that includes lots and lots of pine straw used.
Yeah, pine straw is a no-no in a situation where it can burn and would burn something up. Yes, pine straw is a common problem.
Now, I do want to address ocean acidification just because we're coastal, we're right here on the ocean. We know it's affecting the world seafood industry, which is both an economic impact as well as it's threatening a protein source that billions of people rely upon. Can you explain what ocean acidification is? We've probably heard that term before, but what is it and why is it connected to climate change?
Yeah, what's happening, climate change, of course, is based on an increase in CO2 and other greenhouse gases. And the ocean absorbs some CO2, and that CO2 then combines with carbonate ions in the ocean water, and forms H2CO3, which is carbonic acid, and that's what acidification is excess of carbonic acid, such acid will actually dissolve calcareous shells when it gets very strong. And it's done things like off Alaska, one of the crabs, I can't remember the name of it, but that was a major industry for portions of Alaska.
Dissolving the shells of some of these marine creatures.
Yeah. but the biggest thing that people seem to be worrying about with acidification is coral reefs.
Right.
Coral reefs are very vulnerable to acidification. And at the same time, the water's getting warmer. So it's a double whammy for coral reefs here that we've got to worry about.
Right, and you pointed out in the book, Escaping Nature, that ocean acidification actually has effects like impairing the sense of smell for salmon, which means they have a harder time finding their mates or finding their natal waters or even detecting predators.
Yeah, finding, they have a hard time, they think, finding their water, their when they go in to spawn, finding the right place. They want to go back to the where they were. And yeah, it's impacting on so many things biological. It is a major problem.
But it does seem to be helping some sea snails, blue crab, and lobster.
Oh, I've heard that, yeah. Actually, that's the way it always is, I guess, with these things. It damages and destroys something, but then something else comes there to take its place, which is good, of course, but if it's in the natural world. But basically, you know, what are we going to do if we don't have coral reefs? Oh, my. I mean, that's such a incredible organic community that everybody loves and everybody likes to swim over if they can get near one.
Now, you suggest farm raising seafood, which is happening locally in southeastern North Carolina, especially with shellfish, and some of Wilmington's best restaurants are now turning to some of that sustainably farm raised seafood. There are other suggestions in the book about, for instance, the Netherlands Institute for Sea Research finds that spreading, I don't know how you pronounce this, but olivine, is that what it is?
Olivine, yeah.
Along the beach. Yeah. It can work against ocean acidification? How?
Yeah, I don't know how that happened, but it has to be some dissolution of the mineral. Olivine is an igneous mineral that was once molten. And it's not very common, actually, but it's found in volcanic areas. And somehow it chemically reacts with seawater, and it's proven to be. But where it's been used, it's been good. But I don't think it's not widely used at all, though, that I know of.
And this is sort of broadly for climate change itself, not necessarily ocean acidification, but UC Davis researchers found cows emit 82% less methane when seaweed is added to their diet. They burp and they fart less. So how?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Seaweed? Does that work for humans, too?
I haven't heard that it works for humans. I don't think it does.
Okay.
It is really farting and production of gas. And there's so many cattle in the world that is a significant source of methane, which is a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. It's not as common as carbon dioxide, but it's quite a bit more powerful. So that's very important, and that I have a feeling that that's the kind of thing that we may take advantage of and start producing or mining seaweed for the purpose of reducing methane production by cattle.
And you do say, though, we should be preserving kelp forests. We need to protect them as nature preserves. Why are kelp forests so important to a healthy ocean? Kelp forests?
Oh, yeah. well, it's like anything in the marine environment. It plays a role. I don't know specifically much about kelp, but any major component, the loss of any major component changes the world, at least around there where it is. And that's happening so much. We have, you know, I have a statement here that, from somebody named Robert Sanford, who was a Canadian water expert. And he says that, you know, he knows that we've located our agriculture and built our communities and all the associated infrastructure in places that were appropriate at the time we thought when we built them, and now we know because of climate change, he said it should be deeply alarming to all that climate we have taken for granted for so long is right before our very eyes being replaced by climate that, unless we act now, we may not survive. So that's the same thing can be said for components of that, of a biological system. When you change, when something, because of acidification or something else, changes, then you know, all bets are off. It's a whole new world for the biological system.
Now, one of the things that you suggest is that cities will, to be more attractive as places to live, as the earth gets hotter, they'll need to create more public splash parks and swimming pools and more shade. You even suggest painting rooftops and walls white. Will this really make a difference? Painting rooftops on buildings and painting walls white?
Yes, why not? It will help. It will. But those things have to be looked at very carefully. Will painting rooftop be useful in the long run? Will it be useful in the summer, in the winter, I wonder about that, but it might be very helpful. Why not?
You know, another issue that you raise is probably pretty controversial, but Ecuador, first country to codify in its constitution the rights of nature, biospheric justice. How can nature having legal rights change the way we make decisions that impact nature?
Well, in reality, we'll overrule nature, but they actually use that. Ecuador actually used that in order to stop a mining operation, and because of all the damage it was going to do to a rainforest. And that's an example of a good, now maybe, well, what if that mining operation was getting something that's really essential to the life of Ecuadorian? Why, I managed we would overrule that.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Orrin Pilkey, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure.
The book is Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change. Thanks also to the good folks at WUNC. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. Find the episode at whqr.org or wherever you get podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.